I want to start today with a story, and we're going to hear lots of stories today, but I like Signal, I use Signal, maybe some of you also use Signal, and you might have noticed during the latest AWS East outage that your Signal stopped working. Did anybody have a similar experience? Yeah, and I live in Berlin, and I was messaging other people in Berlin, and I found this quite peculiar. Of course, later, Meredith Whitaker was asked what happened, and it was like, well, there's no other choice, right? There's no other choice. Okay. Yep, at least she also said that's a problem, right? There's no other choice. But what I'm going to ask us today repeatedly is it a story or is it a fact? I'm a scientist. I come from machine learning science, data science. And what I want us to keep asking around this sovereignty debate is it a story or is it a fact? And if we think it's a fact, I want us to ask, why do we believe that fact? I want us to assemble evidence, and I want us to test it like we would everything else with the scientific method. Okay, so who's with me? Wants to talk about stories or facts? Yeah? Okay. All right, I'm going to tell you some other stories that are going around. This is the BSI, so if you live in Germany, you're familiar with the BSI, who does a lot of things around type of our infrastructure security and the policies around it. And they signed a deal with AWS because AWS is so advanced in cloud security that they're the only ones that the German government can learn from, right? It's true, right? Must be true, right? And it continues in a lot of the marketing that you look at around this that says that sovereign clouds might be good for your legal department, but they lag behind in things like AI. It's just impossible. And this tends to be the story around US technology companies with this idea that somehow there's something very special about US technology companies or US AI companies that means that nobody else in the entire world can understand how to do this. Okay? It's a story. Then there's another story going around, which is it's sovereign if it's controlled by us, asterisk, for us, asterisk. And here's an example of T-Systems. And we see at the bottom, it's streng geheim, right? Like it's very secret. And T-Systems controls that. And that means it's sovereign regardless of what runs on top of it, right? And AWS went so far as to actually require EU citizenship to work on the AWS sovereign cloud, which means many persons in this room, including myself, who is not yet a citizen due to the long line in Berlin, would be unable to actually work on this regardless of our capabilities, right? Because something about citizenship must bestow sovereignty. And then there's a third story, right, which is something military, and sovereign means let's build military drones and police systems and all of these things. And we can see a lot of this push in the changes to the AI Act that happened, which basically made an entire huge loophole for things like border control, military, and police. So something sovereignty means let's use all the AI that we can for such systems, right? And we see this with Tails. Okay, so it's my opinion, and I hope you're with me, that it's time to spread other stories. And I think I was very inspired earlier today in the AI Plumbers Room. I think there's already some stories I'm hearing that are echoed in this talk. So let's spread some different stories. First and foremost, I think very happily that I hear for many years here at FOSDEM is let's try thinking about building hardware and infrastructure differently, which coming from the machine learning side, so my background is in machine learning, means we need to have new silicon chips and we need to have new designs for silicon chips. And how do we deploy this with any reasonable security? Well, OpenTitan, which I think there might be some contributors to the project already here, is one such way that we can start to think about these things and we can start to open up silicon for different types of machine learning workflows. Alongside, there's also some pretty cool conferences growing around how do we actually do this in more efficient ways, and whatever we mean when we say green computing, how do we do that for machine learning? And the EcoCompute conference this year in Berlin was sold out, but I'd be very happy to hear of other conferences that you might recommend where people are talking about how do we actually increase efficiency of the types of workflows that we're running and use that instead of thinking what is the next biggest gigabyte center or whatever we can build. And I want us to take very Bernie energy when somebody comes at us and they start talking about however many flops they have or other metrics like this that the gigafactories use, because at the end of the day, this is usually an extremely inefficient use of the resources that are available. It's also not possible with the energy density in most places. And thirdly, I've been doing machine learning before gigafactories, so I'm happily here to tell you, and many of you probably too, that you actually don't need gigafactories to do whatever it is that we call AI today, and we don't always need the next biggest foundation model for obvious reasons. And how might we build things differently, both from a green compute point of view, but also from changing the way that we think about AI communities or machine learning communities? Well, I come from a background of decentralized machine learning, and I don't know, for those of you that are also in federated learning or decentralized machine learning, Flower Labs, which is also a European startup, built out the first pre-trained LLM of 1.3 billion with the same accuracy of its competitors, all via federated learning across multiple continents with normal data center links. And these, by the way, were separate types of data center structures, so they weren't all on AWS or Google Cloud or something like this, right? So you can check out. I think there'll be some more exciting announcements this year for other models that will be released the same way. I also sit on the jury of the Splend Composite Learning Challenge. I don't know if you're familiar with Splend, but it's a part of the German government that is looking for what they call Sprung Innovation. So how do we take a leap with our innovation to go from where we are today to something totally new? And the Composite Learning Challenge is about how do we actually learn across very disparate types of hardware? And when we're able to do that, we're maybe able to expand our idea of what do we need in terms of compute to actually do machine learning at scale and even to do machine learning at a variety of sizes. So not always training something with billions of tokens or billions of parameters. And I was here, if you're in Berlin, there was a few last year, there will be a few more this year, distributed AI hacks, where teams get together, compute was donated by AMD, and a few of the teams from the composite learning provided the software and some of the infrastructure layer for running these. So I encourage you to also do these types of things. And what we're moving there is to what we call participatory learning. So a place where you can show up with your own hardware, with your own data, and be able to contribute to building a model which you can also take a copy home with you, right? And to do this, we also need to enable kind of how do you use that model, right, once you have it, or how do we reason about the different open weight models that are already available today? Well, over in the other room right now, unfortunately at the same time, there's some of the core contributors of GGML talking, which is basically if you've ever run one of the LLMs on your computer, there is a good chance that some part of it was using Llama CPP. And then there's a good chance that that is also then using GGML. And this is essentially ways that we can take something like tensor computations and we can move them over to a variety of different hardware backends. And hopefully, eventually, over time, this becomes kind of seamless and something that people can use. But GGML, as far as I understand, still has like three core contributors, right? So we really are, again, in this precarious types of situations where we have a very small amount of libraries supporting, again, a very large or growing infrastructure around running models locally. We have a new act in the EU called the Data Act. It went into effect last year, which basically gives you the rights, if you're an EU resident, that if you buy something, that you have a right to get the data from it. How this will actually play out, I hope it doesn't play out like the GDPR data portability, which basically a lot of companies just hand-waved and gave you your user form back. But what we really are trying to get is, how do we get at the data that you can then take along with your local libraries, and you can run things locally for you and by you, you being an individual in this case. Oops. And I ran last year at PyCon Germany, Pi Data Germany, the feminist AI LAN party. How many people are old enough to have attended a LAN party before? Yes, if you want to come to Darmstadt, if you want to bring your computer, come to our LAN party this year. We're going to host it again. It's in April, but we basically had a few different computers. That's my little machine. It's got a 32 gigabyte GPU in it, and we hosted and served for inference numerous models. We did a little bit of fine-tuning experimentation. I ran a workshop on hacking LLMs for feminism, which is a very fun exercise. And if you want to donate compute, it's free. You don't have to have a ticket to PyCon. You can just show up. So I want to see more events like this. We open sourced all our kits, so if you want to run your own, please do. But by this, I mean bringing your data, bringing your compute, getting together as a community, and really having a participatory way that we kind of also debunk some of these myths around how machine learning and AI works. On top of that, so most of my work is actually on deploying privacy technologies in deep learning systems. What does that mean? That is a lot of random words. What part of it means is differential privacy. Has anybody here heard of differential privacy? Use differential privacy? Yes, I want to see more of that hand. So differential privacy is basically a really robust, mathematically based, probability based method for us to try to measure what is the amount of information you're contributing and how can I attach that amount of information you're contributing to the level of privacy that you might be leaking via your contribution. And by limiting this via a variety of ways that we use in differential privacy, we're able to then give you some reasonable sense of a guarantee. Now, of course, does this always translate? No, right? Technology isn't magic, and privacy is a social phenomenon, right? So I don't want to say all that, but I do want to say differential privacy is available. There's lots of cool libraries. There's many amazing researchers here in Europe working on differential privacy, and I'd like to see those logos grow beyond just Google and PyTorch and Harvard, right? I want to see the logos on the differential privacy that we have available for us grow. And if you're interested in integrating differential privacy in open source that you're working on, please feel free to come find me and let's talk, or find that person and talk with them. Sorry, that was very not private to point at you, but yes. So let's build that. Let's make this normal, because when I think about sovereignty from an EU perspective, maybe, or even from a European perspective, we have an understanding here that privacy is a human right. And it's not necessarily every place in the world where that is a fundamental understanding. And so I think this is one way that we can really add to the diversity of projects and experiences out there when we think about AI and machine learning. I come from a background of working on encrypted machine learning. I worked on the TF Encrypted library, which was the first library to do multi-party computation or encrypted computation for deep learning training with TensorFlow at that time. Most of the cryptographers, the project is kind of archived now, unfortunately. Most of the cryptographers that I worked with moved on to Tsama, which is in France, and they work on new protocols for developing fully homomorphic encryption, but also MPC protocols, ZK proofs, these types of things. And they have a lot of cool open libraries. There's OpenFHE is growing and really cool, and there's plenty of people that are starting to work on the compute problem that we have when we think about encrypted computation. And to just summarize it, it means that we need maybe new types of chip We need new types of maybe even optical computing that allows us to do the expensive steps that we have in encrypted computation and allows us to do it faster, right? And encrypted learning and inference is real. It's certainly not comparable with what happens on plain text, but I would love to see this side of this slide grow and change. And even to hear from you all, how are you building maybe encrypted computation into parts of your projects? So if anybody wants to dev room any of these together next year, please let me know. Finally, open source communities. I mean, I've talked a little bit here of geographies, US, EU, these things. But open source communities, I think, are a really good example of diplomacy overall. And I think we need diplomacy right now in a big way, in many, many ways. And I personally think, and I don't know about you all, but I personally think that open source can be a way that we achieve this diplomacy when other geopolitical tensions are rising, right? And so I point out PyTorch. You know, this is one type of AI open source project. I love PyTorch. I've been using PyTorch now for many, many years. But many of you probably know PyTorch is a project from Meta, and it is mainly driven by core developers at Meta, right? And so it really is kind of driven by that roadmap and that decision making. Of course, there's many, many contributors who are not working at Meta and many, many places that are improving other libraries that touch PyTorch that aren't Meta. But this is kind of one community that, again, is international and reaches across many different types of machine learning communities. And then we have scikit-learn, which is a very different type of community. Scikit-learn grew mainly through just open source contributors who for a very long time were contributing on top of their day job, right? It was not their main project. And scikit-learn has an even bigger amount of people using it, and currently also finally got some funding and support from the French government, including most of the core contributors are now working at a company together, and yet it still has many contributors across other places. So I want to share this as two examples where if you use this definition of sovereignty like citizenship, these projects could never exist, right? Or if you use the definition that we don't ever use US tech or we only use this or that or whatever, these communities might also not exist the same way that they do today. And so I want to encourage again us to think through diplomacy as part of our work. And of course, more than anything, we need to think about prioritization, funding, and we need to be imaginative. We need to think through conversations that are being had right now around competitiveness and scale. And what I think around these is not only we need more collaboration, which I'll get to in a second, but we also need to decide, like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, what is the scale that makes sense for us, right? Because not everything needs to be foundation model scale. There's many different types of machine learning beyond that, and perhaps that is one way to counter this conversation around competitiveness. And then I think we have to continue the idea of collaboration and diplomacy, maybe start building in how do we support open source as part of EU tenders and not just the same five companies that always get tenders, right? How do we combine that with investment? The composite learning is doing a lot of reaching across borders of how do we connect HPCs with EU clouds, but I think there needs to be more of this as well. And how do we do this in a composite learning or a federated learning type of setup? And obviously with ODMs and supply chain, we need to collaborate and do diplomacy to build new types of chips, new types of open silicon that allow us to run inference or training workloads, but also start to develop open standards that can compete with people that have two-year waiting lists for purchasing. So I'm going to leave you with a few questions, but I want to hear yours after this. So I'll be around today, and tomorrow I'll be hanging out in the privacy and internet dev room mainly. But can I decide for what does sovereignty AI, sovereign AI mean to me as an individual? Can I decide how I interact with a model? Can I decide not to interact with a model? Can I choose what models I use based on how they work for me? And if I'm doing that, that means that I need to be able to test locally. So can I run models locally? Can I run them on my own data and on my own compute? And can I support, can I take my portability, and can I support projects, organizations, not only with code and contributions and such, but also with my data, should I want to, right? And perhaps we can think about this from whatever it means to have a European perspective. I think we need to talk about and think about what does it mean to build human rights, like privacy and agency, into AI ecosystems, machine learning ecosystems, and model development. How can we discuss sovereignty without forgetting lessons learned from nationalism and from war, right? Which I think maybe we can have a unique perspective to contribute. What becomes available if we forget about whatever we mean when we say global scale? Your local park bench is not global, right? But it serves a purpose, right? Can we move beyond this idea of scale? And how do we use our diplomacy and collaboration to grow and support international open source communities? So I want you to challenge the sovereign status quo. I want you to gather real constraints and evidence. If somebody tells you nobody does that, I want you to reply, yet. I want you to stay creative, get curious. I want to replace zero-sum conversations, which means we have to do either or no, but. I want you to replace that with yes and I want to nourish hope. So this is me deploying to EC2 in 2010. I nearly got fired for it because the app that I was running fell over at one point in time. And I got called into the IT director's room. And he told me, you should forget about this Python thing, and you should forget about this cloud thing. And then maybe you'll have a future in technology. Thankfully, I did not listen to this person. I left the company, and I went on and did other things. But I want you to have the chutzpah that Lil KJam had then. I want you to have chutzpah and courage to say, no, we don't have to do it the most obvious way. We can do it a different way. And I'm pretty sure that in 15 years, if you start that journey now, you will look back and you will be proud of yourself. So thank you very much for your time today. I look forward to talking with you later.
Maybe I will use this one. Thank you. We don't have time for questions.